I'd like to start this lecture by posing a question. Is it possible for a work of literature to constitute the core of an entire culture around which everything else revolves and from which everything else derives? In both ancient Greece and ancient India, this is exactly the situation that we come very close to. It's almost impossible to overstate the importance and centrality that the works of Homer had for the ancient Greeks, or that the Vedas and epics held for the civilizations of ancient India. Here's one statistic that might help to give you just some sense how important Homer was to the Greeks. Archaeologists have found 1,596 different works of ancient literature preserved on papyri in Egypt. And Egypt is our source for almost all literature from antiquity, because it's there that the dry sands preserve things as fragile as texts. Out of those, so out of about 1,500, over half are copies of Homer, translations of Homer, or commentaries about Homer. To put that in a modern perspective, just imagine if, let's say, half the books in your local library were by or about just one author. Imagine if half of all websites on the internet were about just one author. There is simply nothing in our culture today that even begins to compare in terms of influence to the significance of Homer for the Greeks. I suppose the closest maybe today we come is something like the Bible or Shakespeare. But still, you know, half of all books, TV programs, movies, songs, and websites aren't just about the Bible or Shakespeare. In ancient Greece, education itself consisted mainly of memorizing long passages from Homer and discussing them. So Homer forms the very foundation of Greek culture, and he also kind of dominates that culture in a way that really is difficult for us to comprehend today. If we turn to ancient India, the Vedas and the epics occupy a similarly central role. And I suppose you could even argue that they were even more important to Indian culture, since the Vedas were not just at the center of it, but as we've seen, they themselves are sacred texts. They give accounts of the gods, they list prayers, and they contain statements of belief and theological doctrine. The epic poems of Greece and India not only share an analogous degree of importance within their respective culture, but there's also a number of surprisingly specific similarities in the societies and the cosmologies outlined in these works. And this is probably not because one set of epics directly influenced the other, although some have tried to argue that, but rather this is an example of parallelism, in which two separate societies go through analogous stages of development. While there are many similarities between these great formative epics, there's also some crucial differences. And in this lecture, I want to look at some of each. First, let's think about Homer. During the Greek Dark Ages, just about the only people who were still traveling from little village to little village were wandering storytellers, what we call bards. And they would go from place to place and provide entertainment by chanting long epic poems, usually telling of heroic adventures. And nothing here was written down. Writing had been lost, remember. The poet would know the basic outline of the story, and then he would improvise by combining stock phrases that he had memorized with new material, but all of this had to be done according to a metrical scheme. These epics were not set at the time they were composed, during the Greek Dark Ages, but rather they were about the era before the Dark Ages, what today we would call the Mycenaean era. And by the end of the Dark Ages, people knew really very little about what had come before them. But over the centuries, the Mycenaean era had taken on a kind of aura of being a more glorious, a more heroic age, and the people of that time had been transformed into mythical, larger-than-life figures. Some of these oral poems that had been recited by the bards wandering around finally are written down after the rediscovery of writing around 750 BC. And of these, the two most important are the Iliad and the Odyssey, both of which traditionally are ascribed to a person named Homer. Now, whether Homer was a real individual or a composite of different storytellers is something that scholars have been debating and probably will continue to debate forever. But for a long time, there was even doubt as to whether such wandering oral poets ever really existed. And a lot of the skepticism that people had came from the fact that scholars simply doubted the ability of a human being to be able to spontaneously make up and recite off the top of his head poems of that enormous length. Well, in 1934, a young Californian named Milman Perry, who was a brilliant linguist, got interested in exactly these issues. And eventually, he ended up going to Serbia, where he found illiterate oral poets who wandered from little Serbian village to Serbian village, and they would spontaneously compose and recite rhythmic poems. He got one of these old guys to sit down in front of him for 4 hours a day, and he told him, make up and recite a poem and see how long you can go for. Well, 2 weeks later, he said, all right, that's enough. And ever since that demonstration, people have taken the idea of oral poets such as Homer much more seriously. Unfortunately, at the age of 33, Milman Perry died in an accident with a gun. And here, remember Michael Ventris and the decipherment of Linear B? He was the other brilliant young linguist who died in a freak accident at exactly the same age. The lesson appears to be that if you make some groundbreaking linguistic discovery about archaic Greece, you should be very, very careful in your early 30s. Where did Homer get his information from? Well, his poems are really a mixture of different things. Some of them are information remembered from earlier times that's been passed down. And that's combined together with myths and then fleshed out sometimes with specific details that Homer takes from his own time. For example, Homer knew that the Mycenaeans fought using chariots in warfare. But at Homer's time, people no longer fought in Greece using chariots. Soldiers now fought on foot. So Homer, intellectually, knows he has to put chariots into the poem, but he doesn't know how chariots were used in battle. His solution is that he has the warriors in the Iliad climb into their chariots before battle, then they drive to the battlefield, and then they hop out of them and fight on foot. So the chariots basically get turned into taxis. Today, it's probably more common in schools to read Homer's Odyssey. And that's because it has a very colorful cast of monsters, and the adventures of Odysseus are just very entertaining. But for the ancient Greeks, the Iliad was the much more important poem. It was by far the more influential text for the Greeks, and it's the Iliad that we can really regard as the cornerstone of Greek literature and culture. The Iliad is set during the Great War, which all the Greek city-states have joined together to fight against the city of Troy. Troy is located on what is today the modern coast of Turkey. Archaeology has found the actual remains of Troy, and so it seems like this story may be at least roughly based on an actual historical conflict, which probably took place towards the end of the Mycenaean era, maybe around 1200 BC. And today, often when we read the Iliad, we tend to focus on Homer's complex characterizations or the moral questions that his works explore. But it should be kept in mind that the Iliad is, first and foremost, a war poem. Long, long stretches of this text are made up of really a seemingly endless series of back-and-forth battles, which are described in very graphic detail. The Iliad also gives us a lot of information about just aspects of Greek culture, most importantly, Greek religion. In Homer's poems, we see how the Greek gods, even though they're immortal and possess great power, are not morally superior to human beings. They're neither omnipotent nor omniscient. And the gods possess all the very same emotions and behaviors, both for good and bad, as humans. So, at times, the Greek gods can be generous, they can be caring, they can be kind. But they also are often cruel, vengeful, even capricious. And the Iliad offers to us models for how humans can interact with the gods. And it contains completely realistic and very, very accurate descriptions of how you should pray to the gods, what sort of prayer formulas you should use, and how you can gain the gods' favor through performing rituals of sacrifice. Another thing about the Greek gods is that they are actively interventionist in mortal affairs. So, at various points during the Trojan War, they will take a hand in manipulating events, as when Zeus sends a misleading dream to Agamemnon, who's the leader of the Greeks, that incites him to launch an ill-conceived attack. At times, the gods will cause spears or arrows to hit or miss their targets, as when Athena influences the path of an arrow shot at the Greek hero Menelaus. Sometimes the gods will even swoop down from Olympus to save their favorite human from death and carry them away to safety far from the battlefield. And the most famous example of this is when Aphrodite rescues Paris right when he's about to be killed, and she just drops him off snugly in his own bed. Sometimes the gods will impersonate humans in order to deceive them. Athena, for example, pretends to be Hector's brother, Deiphobus, in order to lure Hector to his death. And finally, the gods will sometimes even come down and fight themselves. So, for example, the god of war, Ares, joins in the fighting and ends up getting wounded by a mortal. When we turn to the great oral poems of India, the Vedas and epics such as the Mahabharata, we can immediately see a number of basic similarities. Like the Iliad and the Odyssey, these works were composed and originally performed as oral poems that are recited aloud. Like the Greek epics, the Indian poems are not written down until hundreds of years after their original composition. And also, very, very similar to the Greek epics, the Indian ones are set in an earlier, more heroic age, which is glorified and idealized in exactly the same manner that the Greeks of the Dark Ages looked back on the supposed glories of the Mycenaean era. In addition, the Indian gods influence events both through advice that they give to characters and also by direct intervention. So, just like the Greek gods, the Indian gods will work undercover. They'll disguise themselves. And a very dramatic example of this is when the god Yama goes along on an expedition in the disguise of a stray dog. Or when the god Krishna acts as the charioteer for the hero Arjuna and gives his very famous summary of Hindu theology. Just like the Greek gods, the Indian gods also have their favorites, whether those are individuals or groups whom they assist and give advice to. And of all the Indian epics, probably the most similar to the Iliad is the Mahabharata, because it too tells the story of a great war between two powerful factions. Both the Iliad and the Indian epics describe a society that is organized into small, what we might call tribal kingdoms, in which a warlord and his respective retinue fights against other warlords for supremacy and for status. And these are clearly male-dominated societies. So even though every so often you'll get the occasional depiction of an upper-class woman, and sometimes even she'll have influence or command respect, the portrait we get of the lives of ordinary women in both these societies is unfortunately rather negative. It's clear that in both societies, women hold a subordinate legal and social status. Men, on the other hand, in these societies, are intensely concerned with maintaining their public status. And one of the easiest ways to do that is through an all-male activity, warfare. So in both poems, the details of war are very similar. You have warriors fighting one another with the same basic weapons, swords, spears, bows, shields, and chariots. One difference is that the Indian heroes also get to employ war elephants, though. And a lot of the fighting centers around besieging and capturing fortified towns. So the Iliad, of course, is set during the 10-year-long siege of the city of Troy, where if we look in the Rig Veda, we find many, many stories of attacks against little fortified strongholds, which are called pur. And just as the Trojan War may preserve the memory of a real siege that took place during the Mycenaean era, all of these recurrent Indian accounts of warlike nomads coming in and attacking and overrunning these pur, this may well reflect actual events during the Aryan migrations into India. Finally, in both epic poetry traditions, the motive for a lot of the action is insults to people's honor, whether those are real or perceived, and status tends to motivate long-running family feuds. Another plot device that we find in both poems is that the heroes frequently compete in feats of skill and strength to show their dominance or to gain prizes. Often the prize is a woman who they can marry. For example, in the Odyssey, since Odysseus is presumed to have been dead, he's been missing for a long time, many suitors have gathered to marry his widow Penelope. And in order to win her hand in marriage, they're challenged to compete in a great archery contest. And in this, they must first have the strength to string the mighty bow of Odysseus, and then the skill to shoot an arrow through the holes of 12 axe heads lined up in a row. Unknown to the suitors, the recently returned Odysseus competes in the contest in disguise, and of course, he proves to be the only one who can accomplish the feat. And so he reaffirms his role as the king and as the rightful husband of Penelope. In the Indian epics, we see a king arranging a similar archery contest to determine who will marry his daughter. It also begins with the suitors needing the strength to string an especially powerful bow, and then they're challenged to make what is a really spectacular shot. They have to hit the tiny eye of a fish-shaped target mounted on a pole. That would be difficult enough, but to make it harder, the fish target spins on the pole, and then just to make this all kind of ridiculously difficult, they are told that they can only aim at this target by looking at its reflection in a pool of oil. Well, only the master archer, Arjuna, can accomplish this shot, and so he wins the girl. But for various reasons, interestingly, he too has to compete in this contest in disguise. If the Iliad is fundamentally a war poem, also the centerpiece of the Mahabharata is a cataclysmic 18-day battle known as the Kurukshetra War. And this is fought between two sets of cousins, the Kauravas and the Pandavas. Both works have very dramatic descriptions of the fighting, but I think the language of the Indian epics tends to be a little bit more poetic, whereas that of the Iliad a little bit more gritty and realistic. And This is especially true when it comes to the numerous graphic depictions of injury and death in the Iliad. When I read the Iliad with my students, I often ask them to give the poem an age appropriateness rating, as if it were a movie, and almost always they'll give it an R for graphic violence. For example, consider the way that Homer describes the deaths of two heroes. Homer writes, "Idomeneus stabbed Erymas right in the mouth with the pitiless bronze, so that the brazen spearhead smashed its way clean through the head, below the brain in an upward stroke, and the white bone splintered, and his teeth were shattered, and both his eyes filled up with blood, and he blew a spray of blood out through his nostrils and through his mouth, and death in a dark mist closed about his eyes." Another similar passage. "Shining Achilles threw his spear and struck Polydorus in the middle of the back. The spearhead drove straight through his body and burst out the belly near the navel, and Polydorus, moaning horribly, dropped to one knee as the dark mist gathered about his eyes, and he sagged down to the ground, clutching futilely at his own guts as they spilled out into his lap." There is, I think, real horror and shock in the way that Homer describes war. And even though his heroes crave the fame that they win, they're also realistically shown trembling with fear at the thought of injury and death. By the way, one of our very oldest verbal cliches concerning death actually comes from Homer. Several times when a character is killed, he's described with the phrase, "He went down headlong in the dust, teeth gripping the dirt." Or, as we might say in modern phrasing, "He bit the dust." Another aspect of war emphasized in both poems is the kind of berserker frenzy that can sometimes take control of a warrior. And this sort of rage actually forms the central plot point of the Iliad. Contrary to popular misconception, the Iliad does not tell the story of the Trojan War as a whole. It doesn't tell you the beginning, it doesn't tell you the end. It instead focuses on just a little period in the middle of the war. And the poem begins when Achilles, the greatest warrior of the Greeks, gets angry, first over a perceived insult, and then later over the death of his friend Patroclus. And the poem ends, several thousand lines of verse later, exactly when his rage comes to an end. Although the Mahabharata is much longer than the Iliad in length, and really much broader in the scope of its subject, one character in it offers a very nice parallel to Achilles and his famous anger. This is a man named Bhima, who is one of the greatest warriors of the Pandava clan. Just as Achilles is driven by a desire to avenge the death of his friend Patroclus by trying to kill his slayer, the Trojan prince Hector, Bhima is driven by a desire to avenge an insult committed against his wife by an enemy prince named Dushasana. Their respective rages eventually lead both of these men to acts that even their fellow warriors regard as being beyond what's acceptable, even in a time of war. Let's take a look at how the battle rage of these two men is described in the two poems. First, Achilles. "So Achilles swept everywhere, with his spear slaughtering his enemies like something more than a mortal man, and the earth ran with blood. Thus the horses of mighty Achilles trampled over fields of corpses and shields, and the axle under the chariot was covered in blood, and the rails encircling the chariot were splashed with gore, flung up by the sharp hooves of the horses and from the spinning wheels. Achilles, the son of Peleus, raged forward, striving to win glory, his invincible hands spattered with bloody filth." Next, we have the description of Bhima and his rage. The mighty armed Bhima of inconceivable feats blazed up in wrath like a fire fed with libations of clarified butter, like a lion of fierce impetuosity rushing towards a mighty elephant. He alighted on the ground, covered in blood, with blood flowing from his wounds, with face exceedingly red, filled with great wrath, drenched in blood. Bhima threw back his head and uttered loud shouts, even as the mighty and high-souled Indra of 1,000 eyes had roared after slaying Vritra. When Achilles finally has his foe, Hector, defeated and lying helpless before him, look at how he addresses Hector. He says, with a dark look, Achilles answered, "Hector, do not try to reason with me. Do not entreat me, you vile dog. Just as there can be no trustworthy oath between men and lions, nor can wolves and lambs ever bargain with one another, but can only hate, so it is between us. I wish only that my rage would drive me to hack away your flesh and eat it raw for what you have done to me. There will be no one to keep the dogs from feasting on your head. The dogs and the birds will have your corpse to dine upon." When Bhima finally kills his enemy, Dushasana, his rage actually leads him to take the step that was only suggested by Achilles. Drawing then his whetted sword of keen edge and trembling with rage, he placed his foot upon the throat of Dushasana, and ripping open the breast of his enemy stretched on the ground, Bhima drank his warm life blood. Then, gazing at the corpse with wrathful eyes, he said, "I regard the taste of this blood of my enemy to be superior to that of my mother's milk, or honey, or clarified butter, or good wine, or all other kinds of drinks there are on earth that are as sweet as ambrosia or nectar." Those that saw Bhima, while filled with joy at having drunk the blood of his foe, uttering these words and stalking on the field of battle, all fled away, overwhelmed with fear. And they said to one another, "This Bhima must be a Rakshasa." A Rakshasa is a kind of a demon that eats human flesh. In the same way that Bhima's cannibalism is a transgression against the normal rules of accepted behavior, the rage of Achilles causes him ultimately to follow up his killing of Hector by holding a human sacrifice in which he kills 12 young captured Trojans in honor of Patroclus. And then he repeatedly mutilates and mistreats Hector's corpse and won't allow it to be buried. And all of these are acts which are clearly excessive and beyond the normal bounds of behavior. So, while many interesting parallels can be drawn between these Greek and Indian epic poems, there are also some significant differences. One of these is just the scale and the range of subject matter. The Mahabharata alone is something like 20 times longer than the Iliad. The Greek poems are always fairly narrowly focused in content, and they tend to tell cohesive narratives. Whereas on the other hand, the Indian poems are huge, sprawling epics that alternate between telling you stories and then have long stretches of religious instruction and lists of actual prayers. Many of the Indian poems, such as the Rig Veda, are exclusively concerned with spirituality and with discussions of theology. The Iliad does have its portrait of the gods and its descriptions of Greek religious ritual, but there's almost no concern for spirituality or any sort of discussions about how one should live a good life that is moral and in accordance with some sort of religious principles. Most importantly, it doesn't have the same status as a sacred text that characterizes a lot of the Indian poems. Nevertheless, even without that spiritual dimension, the Iliad sits squarely at the center of Greek culture. And so, to return to that initial question about how important a work of literature can be to a society, there is no doubt that the epic poems of Greece and India were transformational within their respective parts of the ancient world, and even today, these works continue to inspire people and to be read by millions who look to them both for entertainment as well as enlightenment. Thank you.